Episode 150. Hello and welcome to episode 21 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's two up top. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Matthew. So Matthew, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, I've been pretty good. Again, trying to enjoy whatever limited football there is. Thankfully, Fulham were one of the teams that were available, but sadly we lost, so it's been a bit of an up and down, but as long as there's something to enjoy, then you can't really complain too much.
No, you can't. At least there's some football to chew over this week, and there's a lot more to chew over as well. And also joining us, I mentioned in the intro, it's episode 150 of the Real Football Cast. So that's another half century to nod towards the pavilion. Max, you're going to help us out this week to celebrate that. How have you been these past 7 days?
Yeah, I've been good, thanks. As I was mentioning beforehand, just, you know, really hoping I can go home and see the family over Christmas. But yeah, very pleased to be part of this landmark episode.
Thank you very much, mate, and I hope everything goes well on the COVID front. We're going to talk all things COVID and all things football and how they merged together this past week and the month ahead in a moment. Before we do that, let's do the social media bits. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my content partner, that being betting.com. For all the tips and predictions you'll ever need, check them out. And also, the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E. You get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? Let's address a pertinent topic off the field, and that is the resurgence of COVID-19 in the UK and the knock-on effect it has within the world of football. So first up, we should address the fact that the Premier League have decided that the Christmas schedule, and a busy one at that, will go ahead in full. The question is, Matthew, do you think the right decision has been made in this current climate?
It's a bit of a weird one, because I think it's the right decision, but it does sort of leave the room of right whether or not it's actually going to prove to be the right decision, because it does seem like if they're going to do this, you just know there's going to be something drastic coming down the line that's going to make everything go wrong. It does seem like they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. I think it was the right decision, but I'm just sort of semi-nervous that there isn't a disaster down the end. Like, I know there's all this talk about putting profits ahead of player welfare and all that sort of stuff, and I sort of get that sentiment, but given how things are at the moment and we don't know what things are, I just think it was a risk that the Premier League sort of had to take rather than, you know, risk running fixture congestion further down the table when there could be more uncertainty. Yeah, they're doing as best they can to try and get as much as they can out the way rather than kicking stuff too far down the league. So I think it was probably the right decision in the end. But if they'd have called it off, I think there probably would have been a large section of society that probably would have understood for health reasons. But I think they made the right call.
Well, Max, in terms of, where are we at the time of recording? Football goes ahead. More importantly, or just as importantly, it goes ahead with full capacities. There's none of the 10,000 caps or anything like that at the time of recording. That could still change in the next couple of days. But does that surprise you slightly? I know we've got vaccine passports in place, but let's cast our minds back to March 2020 now, when Liverpool played at Atletico Madrid in the Champions League, and it was a bit of a COVID hotspot. So is there a concern that could be, not Anfield in particular, but stadiums could become another melting point for the passing of disease?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a worry for a lot of people. Obviously, that Liverpool Atletico match you mentioned was, you know, a bit of a super spreader event, and, you know, people have shown that specific match was hugely, hugely damaging. not only to you know, England, but also to Spain, and you know, and the transmission of the virus there. So I think I agree with Matthew. It's a very emotive and it's a very kind of controversial issue. There's no real exact right or wrong answer. Just about they've come to the right decision in deciding to play on, because with the amount of games there are, I think you just have to play them while you can, and then, you know, there might be a period later on where we absolutely can't because, you know, it's in full lockdown or anything like that, or, you know, 19 of the 20 teams have COVID outbreaks and so it's impossible to play. So while it's possible, you should. But I think probably the next step in kind of locking things down will be to reduce the crowd numbers at the grounds, because, you know, I love being in the grounds. I went to Palace against Southampton the other day at Selhurst Park. I think that's only my second game in a stadium this season. And I used to be a season ticket holder, so I'm used to going every single week for years and years. And so I absolutely love being in the stadium, particularly like Palace, because it's kind of on top of the pitch. It's quite high. There's quite a good atmosphere. You know, you're singing songs throughout and it's really loud and the atmosphere is kind of vibrant and pumping. And I love all of that. I love it. And you don't get that from watching it on TV. And it's a massively important part of why fans like football and why fans go to football. But I would, I would rather be able to take the option of maybe only 10,000 fans being the limit of 10,000 fans being in stadiums if football can continue. And I feel like it's going that way because, you know, so at Palace the other day, they did tell you to, you know, bring your verification that you'd had your vaccine and things like that. But basically it was just a box ticking exercise. A person would come up to you in the queue as you were queuing up to go in and they'd say, have you had your vaccine? And you'd say yes, and they wouldn't check. They'd just tick a box on their sheet and that was it. So it's not the most stringent kind of measures in the world. And I imagine that hundreds, if not thousands across the country will have probably got into the stadium and, you know, lied about it beforehand. And there's no real check on it, assuming that other clubs are treating it the same way as Palace are. So I think it's a bit of a no-brainer that if, you know, the transmission continues to grow and cases continue to grow and things are going the way they're going, I think limiting fans in stadiums is, as I say, a bit of a no-brainer.
Well, it's funny you mentioned vaccine passports and the checking of those, because I went to Newcastle Man City on Sunday. And when you go to stadiums, obviously, one of the issues in general is a lack of Wi-Fi, because everyone's trying to overload the network at the same time. So you need Wi-Fi to get your vaccine passport loaded up. Now, it's kind of minutes to 2 o'clock. I'm faffing about and I'm not getting the Wi-Fi. So Stuart says, oh, actually, doesn't matter too much. We're only meant to check one in three. So you've got 50,000 fans. They're never going to check all of those because the protocol is that you simply can't. So Matthew, that can't help the situation either, can it? Because really, that's 34,000 people on Sunday, which wouldn't have had any checks at all.
No, I think I think the clubs are sort of put in an unenviable position here, because if they want to check every single one, you know, as they arguably should, then there's going to be queues and inevitably there will be, you know, some fans that miss kickoff and they'll say, oh, it's a shambles from the club. Why didn't they, you know, add more staff or whatever to check when fans miss the first 10, 15 minutes? You know, even though inevitably, I know Fulham did this for their game against Sheffield United last night. You know, they were sort of saying, you know, leave early. You know, they're going to open the Craven Cottage gates like half an hour earlier than they normally would. So we encourage you to get early. But even though clubs would do that, there would be the situation of, oh, you know, someone is 10 minutes late and the queues are too late getting in. So someone would complain. But again, at the same time, if they only did spot checks, for instance, then, yeah, as you said, then there would be, you know, as you mentioned, about 30. In a Newcastle situation, there'd be about 30,000-ish that get through undetected, probably the wrong word, but unchecked.
Yeah, yeah.
So either whichever situation you put it up like that, then the clubs are going to be a little bit behind the eight ball, as it were. So they can only really do what they can do. And, you know, so long as there's, you know, the threat, maybe the wrong word there, but the idea, the security that there will be some checks in place, then that might just be enough for some people to say, oh, I don't want to chance it. You know, someone who isn't vaccinated or who hasn't had their, or who didn't take the test, will say, oh, I'll just chance it. If it's 1 in 3, then it's still only, you know, 66% chance I'll be able to get through. But it may be enough for them to say, I probably won't do it just in case I get caught out. I don't want to waste my ticket money and not be able to get in. So either way, I think clubs are pretty down, but they can only really do, you know, as best as they can do, given the circumstances and given, you know, what technology is available at the time.
Yeah, I guess, Max, also a big issue in this is fan behaviour. Not bad behaviour, but just fan culture of going to a match, in the sense that I was exactly the same on Sunday. You're squeezing down one last pint, 10 minutes before kickoff. You know, that creates a bottleneck just in general, passports or not. So you add that to Matthew's potential pinch points as well. And the clubs are damned if they do and they're damned if they don't.
Yeah, very much. It's a really tricky situation. And I was actually saying to my dad, well, you know, just because there was a lot of fans in the way as we were coming down towards the ground, we probably got there a little bit later than we thought we might have. And, you know, as you say, if they were carrying out more stringent checks, then people would be getting in late. And that is really, really what pisses fans off. Right. Because I remember there was a whole hoo-ha at Southampton.
That's
because,
right, yeah.
You know, fans couldn't get in for half an hour, or, you know, miss the whole first half. And that really isn't on. And, you know, eventually they, to their credit, Southampton gave a full refund to all of those fans. But, you know, you can't really have people coming in late. But then, as you say, fans individually, you know, for whatever reason, there might be traffic. They might have left work late. Reasons outside their control. They might just be fancying a quick half in the pub around the corner. It's difficult because not all fans are going to make that effort to get there earlier, even if clubs open the door earlier. And yeah, as I say, you really don't want fans missing parts of the game. So it is a really tricky situation. I think maybe if you, yeah, checked 1 in 3, something like that. It's obviously really difficult to work out exactly how you're going to do it. But I think fans also have to take it upon themselves a bit and say, well, you know, we're lucky that games are still on. We're lucky that we can still go. Let's, you know, change our behaviours in a way that, yeah, it might be different for how we would normally do things. And it might be, and it's not going to be forever. But while this bastard virus is around, we can try and change our behaviour to make it easier for everyone.
Yeah, that's a good point, Matthew. Does it need self-policing from us in general as football fans? You know, maybe let's not worry about that one more pint. Let's get to the ground with a bit more time and ease those pinch points. Because if we don't do that as a society or as a footballing culture, football will go back in the box. It will be 10,000 fans at Premier League grounds. It will be behind closed doors if we're not careful, like in Germany. So it needs us as society to sort of step up and do our bit.
Yeah, that's what I say on the club part. I think there is only so much that the clubs can do, and it does come down to personal responsibility. Now, I personally, I'm not a heavy drinker, so all this stuff like, you know, pre-match stuff in the pub, I really don't care. And I've always sort of made it a policy myself, mainly because I was raised in an army family, so being on time for things was drilled into me as soon as I came out of the birth canal. So I'm always in my seat at least half an hour before the game, but I know not everyone is like that. But yeah, I think there should be something, you know, everyone knows what the situation is. I think that, you know, there probably is enough, like with the Southampton game that Max mentioned, you know, that should really be enough of a scare story to say fans, right, this is what can happen if you don't get there early. So hopefully it is something that the fans take on board, because as I said, there is only so much the club can do. You know, they can open the stadium 3 hours before kickoff. Get a private, I don't know, Dua Lipa concert or whatever to get fans in. Do whatever they can. half price drinks, I know.
Yeah,
Something that's been mentioned. Whatever they can do, but there will still be someone. There will still be some people who do it. So as you said, there does have to be some sort of self-policing, as you say, in something. Right, we know the situation we're in. We know the trouble that it can cause. So now is the time that we, as you say, take responsibility upon ourselves and make sure that we, you know, because you don't want to miss the game. You've paid your money. You don't want to miss the game. So you should know what the situation is and get there at a time, you know, that is fine for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, it's just trying to take out the drinking. And it's not only drinking culture in football. It's not about beating them with a stick. But they are responsible for the pinch points at entry and grounds anyway. You know, the amount of times you'll be in your seat and you'll get a wave of people at 3:03, you're, sorry mate, can I just get to my seat? You know, it happens. It's just with that many people, you are going to get people who are late. But we're kind of trying to make the entry into grounds as seamless as possible with these extra protocols in place. And it's not easy. And it's going to be kind of trial and error, but football can't afford to have too much error in the trial. So we've got to be really careful. But at the same time, Max, from a club's point of view, there's always going to be an element of self-preservation in this, and that's fair enough because clubs will be looking out for their own vested interests. We had Thomas Frank asking for the whole of the Boxing Day schedule to be postponed. That didn't go his way. Chelsea asked for a postponement against Wolves due to a COVID outbreak. That didn't go their way. But then we're getting kind of postponements elsewhere. So where's the consistency between, say, that one, Chelsea-Wolves, or Wolves-Chelsea, shall I say, not being postponed, but then Villa Burnley getting pinged, what, hours before kickoff? That's going to be rather frustrating for the teams that do take to the field when they didn't want to take to the field.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's just, you know, the authorities are having to kind of create rules basically on the fly because this is such an unexpected situation. I mean, obviously COVID's been going on for a year or two or more, but I mean, you know, before there was no precedent about what to do in this kind of situation. And obviously they've had to just like pick a number of how many cases you have in your squad before you call the game off. So I think Chelsea have 7 players out. I think maybe 6 COVID and maybe 1 or 2 were injured. And basically Tuchel was furious that they had to play. But I'm sure that the authorities have just kind of gone according to whatever number that they've plucked out the air as being, you know, too many cases in the squad for you to play the match. And if Chelsea are below that figure, then you have to play. But of course, it's difficult because, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere. And, you know, 7 COVID cases in your squad is obviously a big issue. But, you know, 6 is a big issue as well. 8's a big issue. I don't think you can kind of draw a line between 2 numbers and say underneath that number of COVID cases is fine and above that is not fine. But, you know, you have to have a rule in place so that you can decide whether the game should go ahead or not. I mean, I personally think it would be better to do it on a case-by-case kind of basis. But it's just difficult because Chelsea are sitting there thinking, well, we've dropped 2 points in the title race. And, you know, if we'd have postponed the game to when we had our full squad back, we might have had a much better chance of beating Wolves. And they might have. And so, you know, they're obviously managers that are going to have grievances because I don't know how many Villa or Burnley have out, but if it's a similar number to Chelsea, then Chelsea have a bit of a right to feel aggrieved.
Absolutely. That was going to be in my notes later that although Chelsea got a point, really, the game in hand is probably better there because you can maximise that at a better time for the squad in terms of health and get all 3. So we might look in May, Chelsea might lose the league by a point. You just don't know, do you? The ramifications could be massive. But Matthew, in terms of Burnley, they're going to be really frustrated because I think that's the second fixture in the space of a week where it's been nipped hours before kickoff. Is there anything the Premier League could do better here? If you're a Burnley fan, you know, the frustration of travel, that's the long distance anyway to Watford and Birmingham. You know, it's not ideal, and I know it's kind of not avoidable at the same time, but surely there's got to be a better message or a better protocol in terms of cut-off points and decision-making here. What can the Premier League do better if it happens again in January?
Well, I don't know because, again, I'm not privy. I don't think any of us are privy to how regular the testing is, you know, what the protocols are, you know, when do they test, 24 hours before kickoff, 6 hours before, and so on and so forth. Because you could get, you could get the situation where, you know, the team, everyone tests negative on the coach ride home, on the coach ride down. They stay in the hotel, and it just so happens that one employee on the hotel coughs in the wrong place. All of a sudden, there's 10 different players touching the wrong thing. So even though they tested negative the night before, when it comes to their pre-match test 3 hours before, then they've got it. So there is only so much that is, you know, out of the Premier League's hands. And again, then you don't want to say, right, the last testing cutoff point is 24 hours beforehand, because then you have the situation of plenty player of, you know, those in this situation, for instance, 10 players going round and infecting not just their own players, which could cause problems down the line, but then have it knocked on to the opponents. So again, it's a bit tricky. The Premier League are sort of acting in this, you know, there's only so much that is within their power in the environment that they're in. And again, no one really wants to have it, you know, called off at the last minute. But there should be some sort of understanding, flexibility that this is how it is. Obviously, it is a pain. I'm not trying to sort of belittle it any sort of season or laugh at Burnley fans having to go through this if they're travelling. But I do think there has to be some level of flexibility and understanding of, right, if we want to do things for the safety of the players and the safety, in theory, of the general public as well, because players, when they're taking a throw in by the touchline, I'm not saying this is how it works, but in theory, when they're just in general mixing or out in general public, that they're spreading it around. So there has to be some level of understanding that you just don't know when it is going to come up, and it is just a pain that it just so happens that these come just before kickoff.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's just very unfortunate for Burnley, isn't it? And as you say, Matthew, the repercussions of saying, well, everything 24 hours before is the cut-off, and then what if you had an outbreak and those players played, it wouldn't bear thinking about, really. So again, we're kind of back to damned if you do and damned if you don't. But Max, one suggestion in terms of the strain of the fixture schedule, it's always busy this time of year, in that they didn't want to necessarily get rid of all football across Christmas, but there was perhaps scope to knock off, say, 3 or 4 matches per game week. So each of the 20 teams in the Premier League would drop a game out of the three they would play. So you'd have 20 matches played across the 30-game schedule, if that makes sense. Does that help in any way? I know it's not going to go ahead, but does it sort of go back to the point of playing matches while we can, rather than having this dilemma that which could appear, because there's no guarantee that things will not strike again in terms of COVID. We might have another outbreak in January, February. I hope we don't, but it's kind of getting these matches in the history books while we can to avoid any other pinch points which may follow in the future.
Yeah, exactly, because we don't know what is going to happen in future. Obviously, we might be really severely, strictly locked down for 3 months from January to March. Like, we don't know. And obviously the fixture schedule being that it is, and with all the postponements already this season, some teams have got 3 or 4 games, which they have to play at some point across the already busy schedule. A lot of teams got cup runs coming up. Obviously, the FA Cup is just starting, the League Cup is wrapping up, the Champions League and Europa League, Europa Conference League knockout stages are happening as well. And I think ultimately it comes back to the fact that the schedule is stupidly packed. And we need to find a way of reducing it. There aren't really any simple answers. I mean, a simple answer would be to never ever have home and away legs in the cups, but then that you can say that that's reducing the opportunity for lower league clubs to get a money spinner against a Premier League side or a big side. And so it's really difficult. I think maybe if you have a system, I'm getting into a quite broad topic here, but if you have a system which rewards lower league clubs more, and kind of distributes the wealth more evenly, that clubs aren't just 90% reliant on getting to the fourth round of playing a Premier League team once every decade. If clubs in the lower leagues get a bit more of that wealth that is swirling around English football, and they're not so reliant on those home and away legs against big teams in the cup, then that means we can chop the replays, get, to be honest, I think chop extra time as well in domestic cups particularly, and just go straight to penalties after the final whistle, get it done, get it dusted, and then that will free up a little bit of space in the schedule. But even if that happens instantly, which I don't think it will, there's still a real problem about how hard these players are being forced to work. And a lot of countries, I think Germany have a winter break, don't they? And I would love to see that input in football. And the COVID crisis is actually shining a light on this issue, which is good in a way. It's one of the positives to come out of the situation, because people are thinking, actually, isn't it a bit ridiculous that a team can miss like a week and now they have like 4 fixtures to fulfill at some point in the future, already in the calendar? And players are just going to feel like they finish a season and they have like 2, 3 weeks, and then they're already back with the Club World Cup and whatever other shit is happening, whatever like meaningless tournaments and pre-season friendly tournaments. And I think that Tottenham playing like the Asia Cup or something, or whatever it's called. It's just silly. And we need to reduce the schedule. I'm glad that COVID is shining a light on this, because it's getting to the point where, you know, it's a huge inconvenience for teams if they miss just like a week due to COVID, and it throws the whole season into chaos, basically. And I really don't envy the authorities in having to untangle it all.
Well, I was going to ask you something on that topic, Max, about managers who are also trying to shine a light on this. Jurgen Klopp, Pep Guardiola, always detractors of the busy Christmas period. We get an annual moan. I know we got one from Klopp recently. This situation is obviously got gold dust to him, because he's pretty much echoed what you just said about the idiocy of trying to play this much football in a pandemic with the health issues and all that that sort of goes on. So does it go to being boiled down to, I guess, sort of traditionalism versus common sense? Because English football is all about Boxing Day and the busy festive period and all of this. So will we ever see change? Will we ever see that winter break that everyone from a managerial point of view is asking for? Or will tradition always be sacrosanct?
Yeah, that's a good word, sacrosanct. I like that. Yeah, it's a bit of a tricky one, because, as you say, it's just such a tradition in English football, whereas in, you know, German football and in European football and around the world, they seem to have, you know, much clearer and much more defined kind of breaks in play, you know, between football and that kind of thing. I think, you know, the international football calendar needs to be probably reduced as well. The Nations League has been okay. I would happily, you know, live my life without the existence of the Nations League and just, you know, I don't know, but just remove that from the calendar and allow international players a bit of a break and that kind of thing. I hope we get to a point where we start thinking from a bit more from the players and the manager's perspective. And Jurgen Klopp does love a good moan. He does absolutely love it. But I am actually with him on it, because players are overworked. And yeah, I would like to see the tradition in English football challenged so that we can reduce the schedule.
Well, Matthew, one of the traditions of English football is FA Cup replays, but as of yesterday, they will once again not exist for this season. So we've mentioned the pressure on the calendar. In this situation, there's really little that the FA can do.
No, I think you're right, because again, we're sort of in a situation where they're trying to do as much as they can just in case something comes along, you know, just in case. It is a situation, you know, I'm you know, coming this all the way from the United States and sort of watching this from afar. But my sense is, you know, based on everything that's coming out with the government sense, is I genuinely think there could be a proper, you know, back to March 2020 style lockdown in place. I genuinely do worry about that. And in that situation, you know, all football is cancelled, not just behind closed doors, but is cancelled. And then if they have to restart up again in 2 weeks or 3 weeks' time, then they've got to get, you know, all the fixtures worked out. So to then have the complication of, you know, not just the initial fixtures, but a replay on top of that, then it does seem like, well, we've just got to, for this season. Again, I hope that it doesn't. I hope that they don't get taken away completely. I love the idea of replays. You know, not just the money that they're considering for the likes of, you know, Exeter when they played Man United and Liverpool, yeah, or Burton Albion when they played. But, you know, all these ties that we see. Not just because of that, but also it's more football to enjoy, and there is more of a chance of these little underdogs getting their big day and, you know, shocking a big team. So I don't want to go away completely, but I can sort of understand why they're doing it right now, because again, the situation has been forced upon them.
Well, I guess with the replays, it's kind of with the third round and the fourth round being still in place in general, you know, COVID aside, and then they stop in the fifth round, it's kind of like a bit of a halfway house between traditionalism and common sense again in terms of the fixture calendar. It's offering a little more sort of the legacy of replays, but the FA aren't being brave enough by kind of scrapping it. That is almost death by a thousand cuts. But I see what you're saying, Matthew, that replays are great in the sense that a team like Exeter can get a money-spinning trip to Anfield or Old Trafford after holding a big team at home, such as Burton Albion did as well. So it's a really difficult one. But, you know, football keeps evolving, and replays is probably one thing which is holding the FA Cup back in a sense. But again, it's a really difficult decision, because you need to protect the lower clubs unless the prize money gets bigger. But then again, there's not enough prize money in the FA Cup. So it's kind of spinning plates and trying to find a solution which always never fits everyone. But also, Matthew, for yourself, as a fan of a club in the EFL, they're saying they're going to try and carry on with football where possible, which I guess is the stance they're taking at the moment. is the problem there that there's not enough testing? So there might still be cases throughout clubs, but if their testing isn't in place, you can't cancel the games because you're not finding it in the first place. So is this a bit of a double-edged sword in the AFL?
Yeah, I think it is, and you know, that's the danger that I was sort of talking about. Is, you know, if it gets undetected once, then a couple of days later, all of a sudden, what was one person that, you know, wasn't made to isolate or do anything properly, all of a sudden, again, one cough in the wrong place, all of a sudden becomes 10. Then, when the next round of testing comes along, all of a sudden, it's all panic bells. But again, I also think that the AFL are sort of in a situation because of their schedule, because they're, you know, they play an extra 8 games.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head. Yeah, an extra 8 games. And in a shortened season as well, because their season sort of ends at the start of May, end of April, rather than going on to the middle or end of April like the Premier League. Again, they have got to get these in somewhere. Otherwise, you are looking at the situation where from February to late April, say, there is games every Saturday and Tuesday, you know, every Saturday and midweek, rather than just the odd 1 in 4 sort of thing. So again, they're in a situation of, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't, whatever situation. But again, everyone's just sort of thinking on the fly, because again, we thought that this was all going to be out the way, everything, we, you know, it was all going to be sorted, you know, once everyone had their, you know, or enough people had their vaccines, you know, cases would go down. But because of the changing world that it is, and because it's just how it is, then clubs are having to adapt and leagues are having to adapt, and they're just trying to get the best situation. There was never going to be any one thing that kept any, you know, that kept everyone happy or benefits everyone. You know, someone was always going to be screwed over by the situation, but it is just how the world is, and clubs are going to be forced to adapt to it. Hopefully, you know, I say hopefully, but I said this probably around this time last year, but hopefully just for this season.
Well, Max, I guess the knock-on effect here is that we can't have a season that runs long, because the season next season is starting early because of a certain Qatar World Cup. So we are in a bit of a bind if we don't get things done on time.
Yeah, it's almost as if they shouldn't have gone to Qatar,
yes,
for the World
exactly.
Cup, isn't it? Imagine. So, yeah, that does throw a bit of a spanner into the works, because, you know, we could just finish the season late last time, whereas obviously that just isn't an option now. And so, you know, there's going to be a crunch one way or another, sooner or later. And, yeah, it's all going to be a bit of a mess, sadly.
We're talking of competitions and COVID. Spurs have been kicked out of the Europa Conference League after their forfeit of the Rennes game in match day 6. Now, some will construe this as a harsh decision, but Max, what could UEFA really have done in a situation such as this?
Yeah, it's a very tricky one. It's a very tricky one. What do you think about it as a Spurs fan?
To be honest, and I don't mean to look down on the Europa Conference League, but it's kind of, when you add into the fact that there's a 3 fixture backlog for us to deal with now in the Premier League, I think it's a blessing in disguise. Let's just park that. And yes, it's annoying that a viable silverware option is not going to be taken up this season, but the prize really is only entry into the Europa League. It's not as if the carrot is entry into the Champions League, for example. So I think it's frustrating, but the greater good could be around the corner if it helps us get into the top 4. If we get into the top 4, no one's going to worry about not making the next stage of the Europa Conference League. That's it, really. It's frustrating, but I think you just got to look at the bigger picture. Matthew, is that something you would agree with if you were a Tottenham fan?
If I were a Tottenham fan, given the, you know, trophy drought of, was it 13 years now? Going
Four,
on 14 40, years?
Be 14 what, this season.
14 if they don't get anything this season.
Yep.
I'd be desperate. I mean, it's not the Europa League / UEFA Cup, which I know has some history, has some part of Spurs' history. It's the same sort of competition. It's not that. But it's still a trophy. It's still something for Harry Kane to, you know, say that he won something at Spurs. But, and again, it is something. But I can also, at the same time, understand with the fixture congestion and how close you are to a top 4 challenge. You know, if you were, say, in the middle of the table, then I could sort of say, right, this is our only chance to do something in Europe, then, right, let's go for it. But I can sort of understand why a Spurs fan would say, no, I'd rather just take off that strain on the players and let's go all in for the top 4. But can I just say, on the UEFA, I personally, and I said this last year because I remember it was coming around when Tottenham had their game against was Fulham. It was had their game killed. I said it last year. I think UEFA did it right in that if you are in such a situation where you can't put out your starting 11 and then like three subs or five subs or whatever the rule may be, even if you have to bring in the under 21s or the under 18s, I maintain that it should be play the game or forfeit, because we know the situation we're in. You know, one player getting it is fine. You know, it's what we're in. But if it gets to a situation where it spreads amongst the club, then that's your fault for not containing it and doing the proper protocols properly, Percy. So I think UEFA did exactly the right thing, Percy. And I honestly think the Premier League should do, and the EFL should be doing exactly the same thing. Play the game, even if it means you have to put the kids out or you forfeit 3-0. I mean, it may not be the greatest. Manchester United having to put out their under-18s against... against Brentford, I think it was.
Yeah.
Their game could call off. It may, you may lose, but at the same time, you may be able to get a draw, which would be better than the 3-0 loss. So I think play the game or forfeit. That's been my view since around this time last year. And honestly, even with everything that's changed, I'm sticking to it. So I think UEFA did exactly the right thing.
That's a fair assumption, Matthew. Right, that's the COVID talk out of the way for this episode. I don't think it's going to go away anytime. Well, it's not going to go away anytime soon. So we'll probably return to that in the new year. But let's talk about some football now, because some did take place over the weekend. And Max, for Spurs, a 2-2 draw against Liverpool. From a neutral's lens, would you consider that a point gained for Liverpool or two dropped?
Oh, yeah, that's a bit tricky. I think from the position they were in, being 2-1 ahead and then Alisson making that mistake, he was threatening to make a mistake for the whole game, really, wasn't he? He looked a bit shaky. And I know he made a really good couple of saves, but I thought he looked really shaky. He was kind of flapping at corners and, you know, there was almost that mix-up where the ball kind of just about bounced him and he managed to clear it. After a long ball got played through. But from the position they were in, Jurgen Klopp will say, well, we were 2-1 up, and if our keeper doesn't make an individual error, we win. So he will think they should have got 3 points. But I think Tottenham were very deserving of a point in that game. And, yeah, I mean, I think Liverpool just have to hold their hands up and say, look, we played Tottenham at a bit of a bad time, because at points this season, obviously, Tottenham have been pretty poor. For example, under the previous boss. But Tottenham were in a good moment. They had a really good game. Ali and Ndombele came in, and I thought they did really, really well. So did Winks, actually, to be fair. I thought Tottenham were full value for the point. So I think Liverpool just kind of have to hold their hands up and say, you know what, it's not the worst result. We didn't lose. Chelsea have also dropped points. City are going pretty well at the moment, but, you know, we'll take it.
Matthew, at the same time, could you say it was 2 points dropped for Spurs? Because time after time after time in the first half, that ball over the top, the link-up play, they were getting a lot of joy bar scoring multiple goals. You know, they had one goal in the net, should really have been three. I know Alisson did a great save in Dele Alli, but Spurs were quite wasteful at the same time. So those misses, there's Diogo Jota's goal 10 minutes before the interval. That kind of shows that if you don't take the chances against the best teams, you will get punished in the end.
Absolutely, yeah. You could have made the argument that Spurs could have been, you know, three, you know, could have been 3-0 up, by the time Jota got his goal. So, yeah, but at least it is some level of, you know, progression, because I don't think they'd have put in that sort of performance, you know, the infamous booing off against Manchester United in Nuno's last game. It showed that they are making great strides in that sense. Now they're putting up a fight against, you know, Liverpool, who are title contenders, but at the same time, if you're not going to get those chances, then you are going to be punished. But at least it does show that they are at least creating chances. I know that was one of the frustrations under Nuno, was that they were far too defensive. But now they've got a little bit more of an attacking spring in their step. And, you know, I'm pretty sure the Dele Alli of about 5 years ago would have buried a number of those chances. But at least they're getting there, you know, and hopefully it'll be, you know, enough to see them through the rest of the season, but obviously just cost them on the day.
Yeah, I mean, the progression is night and day under the new manager. There's no doubt about that. Dele Alli should have scored, like you say, the Dele Alli from 2016. No doubt he scores that. But, you know, whether that's really down to him with a lack of confidence, or that's a great save in the first half. Second half, it was a really poor touch, and then Harry Kane does him no favours by also having a poor touch. It was just didn't quite work for Ali in the context of a goal or an assist, but he had a good game overall. Max, in terms of Harry Kane, he opened the scoring with only his second Premier League goal of the season. The big question is, though, should he have been given his marching orders for a tackle on Andy Robertson?
Yes, he should. And I think what really gave Liverpool and Liverpool fans, gave them a bit of a grievance was the fact that VAR didn't check it, if I'm correct. And that just winds fans up, because I know you can't get a VAR review for a yellow card, but in my opinion, the VAR needs to be saying to the ref, I think you've made a mistake here. I think you need to be, looking at the monitor. And yeah, it was a red card. Robertson's was a red card too. Right decision, but Kane should have gone as well.
Yeah, Matthew, I don't think there's any doubt about Robertson's rather crude swipe on Emerson Royale. But the question here is, how does Paul Tierney not see that first time round and come to the very obvious conclusion that everyone is watching at the same time? How's that not a red card straight away?
I'm not 100% sure. You can only maybe assume that maybe he's had his vision blocked off, and I honestly don't. Again, I'm only watching the highlights because of where I am, so I'm not getting the full proper 3 or 4 minutes over the whole incident, what happened in multiple replays. So I don't know exactly what's happened, but you do think in that situation, what can he see? As you said, because it's not as if he's a swing of the leg and he's got the ball. Because if he's got the ball, then it's a yellow card. But yeah, swing of the leg and he catches the Spurs man in that situation. Then it is an obvious red card. So it is certainly a baffling one.
Well, Max, let's be honest. It wasn't a great day for Paul Tierney in terms of his officiating on the pitch. He missed Jota being felled in the box in the first half. No penalty awarded there. You could make a case for Dele Alli also being felled in the box or pushed in the box by Trent Alexander-Arnold, but that's less contentious. There's also the two issues we've just spoken about, which if you're a Liverpool fan, you're aggrieved that Kane isn't sent off, and you're also aggrieved that Robertson is sent off, even though he probably deserved to be sent off. But adding all those things into the melting pot, has Jurgen Klopp got such cause for complaint thereafter? Was he justified in all his comments, especially when he said, I respect referees, but I don't respect you? Is he fair in saying that?
So I also think that Jota should have got a penalty. Although given the amount of soft penalties that Liverpool get, I think it probably evens out that one, which I've spoken about before. But
Simicast gate.
Yeah, I know. I understand it's an emotive issue, right? Because it's an intense game. Emotions are running high. You're desperate for your team to win. You're away from home. You feel aggrieved by not one but two decisions that have gone against you. Major decisions. And obviously, Kane getting sent off in the first half and Jota getting a penalty, which Salah 95% of the time scores. Those are huge, huge game-changing moments. It's not like, he should have given a free kick for something or other. So I understand Jurgen Klopp feels hard done by. Of course, he was hard done by. Decisions went against him. However, I do think that he overstepped the mark a little bit. I think you've got a right to talk to the referee. You've got a right to question his opinions and question his decisions. You've got a right to put your case across to him, both during the game, whether that's to the fourth official or after the game, or in your post-match interviews. And I think it's completely fine for Klopp to say in his post-match interviews or to the ref, I think that was a penalty. I think he got it wrong. No issues with that at all. You've got a right to say that as a manager. Where I think he overstepped the line is talking about how he respects all other referees except him. And also, you've never played football. That's why you didn't give us the penalty. Whether you've played football at a professional level or not is irrelevant to your ability to be a good referee, and it's also, in my opinion, irrelevant to your ability to be a good manager or a good pundit. Of course, playing at a high level helps because it gives you that kind of direct experience. But a lot of the best managers have never played football at a high level. A lot of the best pundits have never played football at a high level. And I don't know about all the Premier League referees, but I imagine that a fair amount of them have not played football at a high level. Has Michael Oliver, who's probably the best ref in the league, one of the best in Europe, has he played football at a really high level in the top two divisions of England? I don't know. If he has, fair play to him. But if he hasn't, you know, it doesn't matter, because it doesn't detract from his ability as a referee. So I thought it was quite kind of demeaning, and quite, it felt like Klopp was taking out his anger by kind of trying to personally insult Tierney, and that's probably what I have an issue with.
Yeah, it's the lack of respect there, isn't it? There's no need for those kind of comments. I think, as you say, you've got every right to take umbrage with decisions that don't go your way, as long as you do it in the right way. But when you have that kind of tone afterwards, I don't think that does anyone any favours, and I wouldn't be surprised if Klopp got admonished by the FA for something like that, because it's not on, really. We were trying to sort of have respect in the game, especially at a grassroots level, you know. If you watch that and you're a young referee, you'd think, well, why do I want to be a referee if I'm going to get balled out by the manager like that? It's just not really the direction we want to go. But Matthew, at the same time, consistency, or a lack thereof, is always a topic on this show. It's always a topic in football. So let's take Granit Xhaka's tackle on Rafinha on Saturday evening. Why is the Swiss midfielder not being given his marching orders at Elland Road?
That is another baffling one. And especially, even more specifically, because Granit Xhaka does have a bit of a reputation for a hard tackle and ill discipline. So it should be, you know, when he is, you know, in and amongst a situation like that, then, you know, whilst we don't want someone's reputation to precede them, we know that this does happen. You know, some people are labelled as divers, so they don't necessarily get penalty decisions for them. And we don't want that to happen, but we know that it does. So with Granit Xhaka, you would think that, you know, if he's involved in an incident like that and Rafinha goes down, that should be, you know, that should set alarm bells ringing in, you know, in Stockley Park, that, hang on, something's going on here. We might need to check this over. As you say, it is just a level of inconsistency. And I think that is arguably the biggest fault in all of it, you know, because I'm very pro VAR and helping the referees have some form of, you know, assistance in making sure that the decisions are right. But if it's not being used correctly and not being used in every single situation that it should, then really what's the point of it? I'm not saying completely scrap it and go back. But you do have to question, why has it been brought in if it's not going to be used if it's not going to be used correctly?
Well, let's go to the next topic in hand, because Max, I think Newcastle fans will have the biggest complaint of the weekend, in that they were not given a penalty. Well, the club weren't given a penalty against Man City when Ryan Fraser was swiped out by Edison. Now, what's more baffling here, this one didn't even go to VAR. So how do you make sense of this one?
Yeah, I've got... I wish I had the answers for Newcastle fans, but I've got absolutely no idea. I mean, A, how it didn't go to VAR, and B, how, you know, even in a world without VAR, the referee should have definitely given that as a penalty. You know, Cancelo is under control of the ball and there's no chance Fraser's ever going to get there. But that is irrelevant because Edison takes him out. You know, you can't just go kicking people off the ball just because there's not a chance that they're going to get to the ball or whatever. You can't do whatever you like off the ball. It's not like carte blanche to just like smash into people inside the box. It was clumsy. It was a penalty. No idea how it wasn't given. Newcastle couldn't feel aggrieved.
Yeah, I was behind that goal and I swear it was in my line of sight. And to a man, or to everyone in the ground at that end, it was a penalty. It's clear as day. And you wonder how VAR is not seeing that. I think the statement they made was that because Cancelo had possession, that was enough for it not to be a penalty. But that's not the rule, is it? As you say, Max, you can't just sort of liberally swipe out players knowing that your teammate has got the ball. That doesn't give you a free pass. It's really, really wrong. And Matthew, Newcastle fans will have more right to be moaned for over the past week, because they had that take place on Sunday. They also had the contentious decision by Mike Dean to allow the goal when there was a head injury at Anfield. The name of the player escapes me. But I spoke to you last week about conspiracies with the Big Six. Now, I don't think there's a post-takeover conspiracy by the Premier League to give dodgy 50-50 decisions against them. But this is a really tough week for Newcastle in terms of decisions which have gone against them.
Yeah, and I still don't believe that. But the more that the evidence sort starts to ramp up, there is just that little bit of thing in your dad that says, you know, maybe they do. Maybe they don't want Newcastle in the Premier League. Again, I'm not saying they do. I'm just saying that's tongue in cheek. But there is just that little bit of doubt being planted. And I know it's been a thing with the Harry Kane incident. I know there was all this talk, oh, he's the England captain, so he gets a little bit of leeway. Well, if it was the case, then surely they'd be giving Tottenham five penalties a game so he could ramp up his goal record sort of thing. But when you look at what Newcastle have had to go through in recent, you do have to say, again, I'm not saying they have a point, but there does seem to be something going, but there does seem to be something going on that they just are not getting any sort of luck when it comes to officiating. Now, again, it's not all down to them. You know, when you lose, when you concede 11 goals in the space of a week, you can't put it down and say, oh, well, if that goal hadn't been given that, they probably would have lost all the games anyway. It's not down to just one decision, but it does just make you think that there really is nothing, you know, it's just such bad luck. Do you think, what's the point? But if we are getting this such bad luck, then you just know that relegation is probably inevitable at this point, because we are not going to be able to get it back out of this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think the Premier League refs are on the take or the league's bent in any way, but if you were looking for a conspiracy theory as a Newcastle fan, you would look to that Madison incident, the Mike Dean call Sunday, and you'd think, hang on, there's a hell of a rap sheet here, but I think that's quite a reach at the same time. But if you were looking for the signs, they are there. Now, Max, in terms of Newcastle, we referenced them before, winning football's lottery, but at the moment, they're playing like they've lost that winning ticket, aren't they?
Yeah, and obviously the mood, I imagine, is better inside the ground. You'll have personal experience of that, and you know, it really feels like a kind of weight has been lifted off collective Newcastle shoulders with Ashley departing, obviously with Bruce going as well, and you know, the new owners are kind of giving quite confident long-term promises about the future. Obviously Eddie Howe has come in, but you know, on the pitch, I don't think there's actually been a significant improvement. The attacking has probably got a little bit better, and you know, maybe playing four at the back gives you a bit more going forward, but it also, you know, on the other side of the coin, takes a little bit away from the defensive side. And I think Newcastle have been massively poor recently, and that was an accusation levelled at Howe's Bournemouth, who went down conceding a huge amount of goals, you know, even with some good defenders in that back line. You know, Nathan Ake is now at City, Steve Cook is a decent Premier League player. I actually don't think that Newcastle have hugely improved since Howe came in. And, you know, we'll give him time and see how he does, and, you know, wait until everyone's back fit and everything like that. But, yeah, I would be worried for their future in the league, to be honest, because if they're going to get to 40 points, they need to win about half of their remaining games.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm sure they're going to strengthen in January, and they absolutely need to, and I'm sure they will, but it may be too little too late for them.
Yeah, fundamentally, they are one of the worst three sides in the division right now. The only saving grace is that they are still 3 points from safety. Like, Watford are still quite bad themselves. It's looking like three from those four. Maybe Leeds if they get really terminally bad, but that's the only saving grace. So they're still just about at arm's length, but you look at that team and it's not good enough to stay up. There's going to need to be reinforcements, but then it's implementing new players, so on and so forth. So you're right, the atmosphere is better in the ground. There's a feel-good factor, at least, from a new era, but the fans will give you everything from minute one to minute 90, which they did, but the team needs to sort of match that or get better, because at the moment, they're sinking like a stone. Going back to referees, though, Matthew, you wouldn't have seen this because you are stateside, but on Match of the Day, they come to a conclusion or some conjecture that you see a lot of soft penalties 1 week, and then the PGMOL say, oh, hang on, I think we got that a bit wrong this week. Let's just be a bit more reluctant to give penalties the following week. And then it kind of balances, well, not balances out, but it kind of goes up, down each week. So is what we've seen last weekend the byproduct of that? They were a bit too tight on the penalty calls to not be accused of being soft again.
Yeah, I think there is some element to that, because, you know, as we discussed in the past, when VAR was, you know, was first introduced, you know, we talked about, and has been talked about, you know, countless times and other outlets, you know, that with VAR, you know, if you gave every single foul in the box and everything was called, then there would be, you know, 8 penalties a game. So I do think there is some element of, right, they've got to keep things sort of under wraps. And with the exposure, particularly with there only being 3 games this week, that I think there is the possibility of, right now, there's, you know, more exposure. So not everyone's going to be focusing on the 3 p.m. games, because, you know, because behind the blackout and everything. But now, you know, everyone can watch these games, there is going to be more focus on it, so we need to sort of adjust what we're going to do, and adjust how we treat things. So I do think this is a thing. Again, it's not part of the conspiracy thing, but I do think there are, you know, make-up calls, as it were, in the Premier League, where they say, if we, right, this was clearly something we got wrong, so next week when you see something similar to this, then you've got to give it away. And at the same time, you know, if you can't be giving this every week, we've got to just scale it back. So I do think there is that flux, as you mentioned. Again, I'm not, whether or not it's totally enforced or whether it's like a subconscious thing that the referees do when they review their own performances, not entirely sure, but I do think, yeah, I do think it is a thing in football.
Max, is one of the more infuriating things being that the PGMOL, and Mike Riley in particular, never puts his head above the parapet and says, actually, do you know what? Sorry, we got that wrong. The company line is always, the system is going great, the technology is fine, but the technology is fine, but surely it's the people behind the controls and the connection between the Stockley Park and the referee, which is still not where it needs to be. You know, it's getting better, but then we have weeks like this and you kind of go back a step, don't you? And we can't keep going back a step, can we?
Yeah, you're dead right. So, but yeah, basically whenever VAR is criticised, Mike Riley says, oh, well, you know, we're making 95% of correct decisions and whatever, you know, facts and figures are all well and good about statistics or percentages of how many decisions you're getting right. But football fans are watching Premier League games, and there are only four games this weekend, and there were still about like seven stupid VAR calls which could have changed the game. And, you know, fans are sitting there scratching their head thinking, is this really the best we can do? And, you know, we're not calling for VAR to go. The technology is working fine. It's just, you know, whatever it is, the rules or the people operating them or implementing the rules aren't doing it in the right way. And actually what Dale Johnson suggested on Twitter, who's the kind of VAR guru online, if you haven't heard of him, what he basically mentioned is kind of causing a few issues at the moment, is that the VAR, the video assistant ref, you know, the actual official who's in Stockley Park doing that job for the game, they are given a very high bar, which, you know, has to be overcome for them to change the referee's decision. So basically, I think the rule is, the wording is something like, if what the referee thinks has happened is even, you know, the slightest bit close to what's happened on the pitch, then you don't overturn their decision. And that's setting a very high bar, because unless the referee has got it completely and utterly wrong and, you know, fundamentally misunderstood the incident, say, you know, he sent off Gibbs instead of Oxlade-Chamberlain or whatever, unless it's completely different from what the ref has seen, the VAR can't get involved, the VAR can't overturn the referee's decision. Whereas there's no scope for these referees to say, actually, you know, I can maybe see how you came to that decision, but I think you're wrong. Have a look at the monitor, see what you think. And, you know, there's no room for these referees to use their subjectivity, because the VARs are all, you know, trained professional referees. And so I'm sure, you know, Chris Cavanaugh or whoever in the VAR booth is well capable of watching that Jota penalty incident or the Harry Kane red card incident and thinking, actually, I think that's a red, or I think that's a penalty. But because of the very high bar, because what the referee has seen is not, you know, hugely, massively dissimilar to the decision he's come to, that they're not really allowed to make any changes. And I think that's the problem, because you have to have a little bit more wriggle room to say, actually, mate, I think you might have got that wrong. Have a little look on the monitor.
Matthew, Leeds are nowhere near where they need to be. They conceded 14 goals in the past week. At what point does Marcelo Bielsa think, do you know what, I might need to change my ideals in football and stop being so pragmatic and just change things about a little bit, because it's not going right for them at the moment?
It's not, but I think he would make the argument that he hasn't really had his full complement of players available. Like Patrick Bamford's been going through his situation. I know Calvin Phillips is, you know, an important player for him. And they, I can't remember the last time. I think it may even have been the first game of the season where there's actually been what would be considered the full strength Leeds United squad from last season, with the addition of Dan James or whatever included in. So he could point to that and say, my methods do work, but we've got these things. But at the same time, there has to be some sort of, you know, flexibility on his part. He is known to be a stubborn manager, stuck in his ways. But you have to think for the good of, you know, for the good of the side. You know, he's done an incredible job at Leeds United, and you know, I'm sure he will go down in Leeds folklore for, you know, taking them out of the Championship for after 16 years, I think it was, off the top of my head, after that many time, and get them back into the Premier League. He will always be revered at Leeds United. But if he wants to leave the club, you know, at least in the Premier League, you know, even if it is 17th, then I do think there does have to come a point where he does say, you know, if these injuries don't sort themselves out, that he does have to change his, you know, he will have to change his ways, whether it be with the formation or style of play that he does, or at the very least, just bring in more players, because he does prefer to have a smaller squad of players to choose from, just because he likes, you know, not having to rotate too much. But yeah, I think it's some sort of change does have to happen soon at Leeds United, or they could very well find themselves, you know, deep in a relegation battle.
And Max, the final question of 2021, is the three-horse race at the top of the table now a two-horse race?
No, I think it's a little bit early for that. I think really? Chelsea is still well involved. Obviously, it's been a difficult couple of weeks for them, and they are now, you know, six behind City, but they're only three behind Liverpool. You know, that's literally one game. Liverpool might lose their next game, Chelsea could win it, and you know, suddenly they've overtaken them. So I think it's probably still a three-horse race, but Chelsea are lagging behind a bit, and that'll be a concern for Tuchel.
Right, that wraps up 2021 very nicely. I might be back next week with a Christmas wish list for each team. I don't know. Depends how much drink is taken over the Christmas period. But at least do the admin for 2021. Max, a sterling effort for this year so far. Thanks for your time this afternoon. Thanks for your time this year. Have a great Christmas period, and I'll see you in 2022.
Yeah, thank you very much. You too, mate.
Cheers, buddy. And Matthew, thanks for wearing the captain's armband this week, most weeks. You've been fantastic, as always. A pleasure to chat to you once more, and I'll also see you in the new year.
Absolutely. You know, all the best to you and yours, and to Max as well, and to all the listeners out there. I hope you know, especially in these times, I hope you guys all have a safe one.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast, and until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.